Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here, to be back at the Philadelphia Society, and with a lot to cover in this morning panel after that those two beautiful papers. There's still a lot of things to be said. Let me organize my remarks along four propositions. And the fourth one is not. I won't develop as I do the other three because that perhaps is a task for the question and answer period. But my first proposition is this: that a two-party system like the American two-party system depends upon an underlying one-party system. There is a sense in which all Americans are or used to be held together by a certain consensus on the goals of politics, morality of politics, and the ends of politics. And a kind of peaceful transition between two parties in power in a regular way, and indeed one might even say a respectable way, presupposes that the two parties don't have revolutionary intents against each other. That kind of a party system depends upon their sharing, in a certain sense, more than the principles that divide them. The question for American politics today is, I think, going to be whether that is still the case, whether there is an underlying moral and political consensus that can help to keep the two parties together or playing on the same field and for the same goals. The second point I want to talk about briefly will concern the party competition of the 1790s, which is, after all, what this panel is supposed to be about or is at least supposed to center on. And I think what we see more or less along the lines that David Bob has eloquently laid out for us, that what we see in the 1790s is the first test of whether a direct open party competition is possible because there's a shared consensus on the goals of politics that can discipline the party competition and keep it from becoming revolutionary, keep it from becoming something closer to the French Revolution, let us say, than to what the internal politics of the American Revolution and indeed even of our bitterly divided politics of the 1790s. The third point I will say in passing is that even in 1800, the great Jefferson called the Revolution of 1800, that is, he got elected, but he did consider the Revolution of 1800 to be in its way as significant as the Revolution of 1776 because he regarded it as the payoff of 1776. This shows you that we can, in fact, endure party competition within a kind of larger moral political horizon. But even in 1800, no regular party system was born into American politics. When Jefferson and Madison created the Jeffersonian Republican Party, the Democratic Republican Party of the 1790s, they didn't intend that party to exist forever. They thought that what they were doing was using party essentially as an emergency device to save the Constitution, to save the Union from aristocratic upheaval and aristocratic subversion by Hamilton and Adams and the Federalist Party. They thought that American politics would go back to if not a completely nonpartisan basis, because that was, I think, impossible, but at least would go back to a low boil, not a high boil, and a fully worked out party system wouldn't be possible or necessary. That did become possible and necessary in the late 1820s and 1830s, and I'll at least allude to that along the way. And the fourth, final point really is about our situation today. I promised my colleagues I would say the word Trump. but I think underlying the issue of Trump really is the question whether or not we have one constitution or two constitutions in America today. There is the Constitution of 1788, 1789, the written Constitution, of course, which is defended on the terms of original intent by many conservatives and moderates in American politics. But there's also something called the living Constitution. And for many decades, the living Constitution was defended by the left as merely a way of elucidating or interpreting the original Constitution. It was more a method than a set of conclusions. But I think increasingly that view is untenable. And the reality is that we have that the living Constitution is not a way to read the old Constitution. It's an alternative to the old Constitution, in which case we face a situation which we have not faced in a long time in American politics, in which there really is a kind of instability in the system and a kind of revolutionary potential in our politics, because you can't have two constitutions at the same time and in the same way in effect. One or the other seems to have to prevail. So let me quickly sort of fill out this outline for us. First of all, it is often said that the American founders themselves didn't anticipate the rise of political parties, and that if they had anticipated that rise, they would not have approved of political parties. This is, in part, this thesis is given color by George Washington's own famous statements, which David has talked about, in the farewell address, condemning political parties as at worst dangerous and at best mischievous in American life. But the fact is, if you look around a bit in the political thought of the founding, you do find some folks, some interesting people, especially here in Philadelphia, who were thinking about parties, and that is, particularly Benjamin Franklin. Franklin had a position not really all that different from Edmund Burke's, not as worked out as Edmund Burke, but he had a notion that parties could be a positive force in politics if they grew up in a Republican setting, if they were held together by a kind of common citizenship, which found, however, one or two or more parties developing to interpret the republicanism of the society in slightly different ways, in a more liberal way or a more strict way, being the typical framework. You know, Franklin was in certain ways the founder or the refounder of Philadelphia. He said about working a kind of quiet political revolution as much through civil society as through politics, so he was involved in both of these things. But he, of course, organized the first volunteer fire department and lending library in the University of Pennsylvania and all sorts of things that were designed to change the city and change the character of the citizens of the city of Philadelphia. And so his attitude towards politics and towards parties is an important one. But even if you take the Federalist Papers as perhaps the most famous expression of this reluctance about political parties, even there, I think that theme can be overdone. The Federalist is about, I would say, is really all about shaping a common constitutional culture for the America that they are founding or refounding through this new constitution that they had proposed. The Federalist is not about merely a multiplicity of competing interests in a large republic designed to check one another and allow some form of deliberation to take place at the Capitol, to take place among the institutions separated in powers in wherever the national capital was going to attach itself. The Federalist never says, despite the fact that many scholars quote it as saying, is in favor of or endorses a multiplicity of factions. The Federalist speaks only of a multiplicity of interest. It never says a multiplicity of factions, because faction is, by definition, an unjust political enterprise in the Federalist. You wouldn't want to have a multiplicity of such things. You would want to have a multiplicity of interests for many purposes, because they do help to slow down politics and to lower the temperature of politics and to lead to better digested, more well-rounded views of what is in the national interest and so forth. But you have a right to your interest. You have a right at least up to some point in the rightful pursuit of your interest. You don't have a right to be a faction and to attempt consciously, as it were, to inflict injustice on other citizens or against the common good. And so from that point of view, you could say the Federalist is all about creating a national party, a party of national unity, reflecting the unity of the nation, reflecting the oneness of the Constitution that they are recommending to the country, and that all Americans or the majority of Americans are designed to be persuaded to enlist in this patriotic political party, this new political party of the Constitution. And one of the miracles of the American founding is that we get out of this intense party conflict in 1787, 1788, without there being an anti-constitutional party in America. Unlike the French Revolution, unlike a lot of other revolutions, by the end of the founding process, you could say, in 1800 at the latest, or 1803 or something like that at the latest, Americans are fairly reconciled with the constitutional system. They may not agree with how the laws are being made or the particular laws that are being made, who's in power, but they accept the legitimacy of the framework, more or less, of the Constitution at that point. This fact, I think, the fact that the Federalist is about building a kind of common public opinion, common political opinion in the country, underlying the diversity of interests and the competition of interests. This basic fact, I think, helps to explain the paradox well known to American historians that the Federalist ceased to be published in New York newspapers in 1788. By 1791, that is just 2 years later, James Madison is back in the newspapers arguing against the Hamiltonian proposals for the National Bank and for the adoption of state debts. And for the whole Hamiltonian system is now at the center of politics. And in those newspaper essays, just 2 years after the Federalist, Madison is calling for a kind of great national political party to rise up and restrain the Hamiltonian program. He's endorsing political parties. He has at least the beginnings of an idea of what a theory of party would be and of the utility of such political parties. For a man who was apparently against them or at least neglecting them in 1788 to have made such a discovery by 1791 has always been a bit of a puzzle to historians. But if, in fact, the Federalist is not as anti-party as it seems, then the two things fit together much more easily and much more carefully. Now, let me say something about those party competitions in the 1790s very quickly. We were very lucky, in a sense, in American politics. The Constitution was released in September 1787. It was ratified by the following year, 1788. The year after that, the French Revolution begins, 1789. One of the things, not the only thing, but one of the things that buffets our politics in the decade of the 1790s, that embitters it, that drives it in ideological directions and on both sides, is the presence of the French Revolution. American politics, Americans like to think of the French Revolution in the beginning as the second act of the American Revolution, the spread of the American Revolution to another country hungry for freedom, individual freedom, and republican government. Even people who would eventually and fairly quickly sour on the French Revolution, men like Alexander Hamilton or John Adams, were prepared to like it. They found it as they could see it as another installment of the great story of human liberty. But it, as I say, it did quickly sour, and it would have tremendous effects on our politics. Rather than us determining the French Revolution, it came much closer to being that the French Revolution determined us in its effects on our politics in the following decade. And so it would not be long before Thomas Jefferson and Madison and others would be accusing, sometimes George Washington himself, certainly the people around him, Adams, Hamilton, and others, of being monocrats, that is, of being secretly desiring to overthrow the Republican government of the Constitution and institute something like a British monarchical system again here in the United States. And the Federalists looked at Jefferson and others and saw Jacobins. They saw atheists. They saw radicals, sans-culottes, and other epithets were hurled at them, designed to show that the same bitter disputes that were breaking out and killing thousands upon thousands in France were about to do the same thing here. Now, we were spared the actual consequences of that. We were spared anything like the French Revolution rising up within America, partly because the disagreements between our partisans were not, in fact, as large as the disagreements between Robespierre and the various other factional leaders in France. That's because both Jefferson and Adams and Hamilton and Madison all essentially agreed on the basic moral theory of the Revolution, on the doctrines of the Declaration of Independence, and on the legitimacy of the Constitution. The Constitution had monarchy in it. It had a strong executive, but it also had and the determining role was played by the Republican side of the Constitution, which was the legislature, the Congress. Monarchy denatured, monarchy that has become a power of government and not the actual principle of one-man rule or prerogative, much less divine right, was useful for republicanism. It was one of the advances in political theory celebrated in the Federalist, that in this form of government, the people's branch, the people own all the branches of the government, legislature, executive, and judicial. They're not confined to the legislature, and someone else, the aristocrats or the monarch, controls the executive power. Reduced in that way, monarchy became an important and vital principle of good government under our republican system. So the disagreements were not quite as radical as they might have seemed. The party fight of the 1790s culminated in Jefferson's breakthrough in the 1800 election, as I have said, the first peaceful transition of power between parties in a free and open government in human history. But once in office, these Jacobins, these radicals in the Jeffersonian Republican Party proved far less radical than the Federalists had feared. Jefferson didn't try to dismantle the Supreme Court. He didn't try to change the terms of the election of the president or his powers. And so in one sense, while there was disagreement over policies like the National Bank and the Alien and Sedition Acts, in another sense, there weren't even that many disagreements about policies. Both parties endorsed the Louisiana Purchase, for example. The political leaders, if you look at this from a kind of sociological point of view, were drawn from the same strata, basically a kind of gentleman, educated gentleman. And so the spirit of mutual deference soon proposed itself within our politics. Up to 1829, so from 1788 to 1829, only 9 bills were vetoed by presidents. There was not a culture of confrontation even between the two branches. And so it was, in a way, perfectly understandable that the Federalist Party eventually faded away. And the Republican Party, regarded by Jefferson as an emergency mechanism, in a way began to fade away too. By the 1820s, if I may now go forward a little bit and complete some of these remarks, by the 1820s, America was well on the way to a regime of legislative supremacy or even a kind of quasi-parliamentary system. Presidents were being nominated not by national conventions, which hadn't been invented yet, but by caucuses in the Congress, by party caucuses of legislators. So the executive was becoming dependent upon the legislature in something like a parliamentary sort of way. The events of the 1820s and the 1830s would shatter that legislative supremacy and lead to a whole new invigoration of American political parties. And I want to say, in conclusion, something just about that. Political participation in those years, in the 1820s and 30s, expanded considerably in scope and intensity. All the new states that entered the Union after the original 13 did so with universal manhood suffrage, then the most radically democratic form of political participation available. In a few of the colonies, the former colonies, new state conventions, political conventions, constitutional conventions, were called to consider dropping property qualifications from the text of the state constitutions. In those cases, in almost all of them, the Jeffersonian Party and the remnants of the Federalist Party united in opposing further democratization of the suffrage. In almost every case, they lost. And so in 1828, something like 54% of white males in the country voted. By 1840, 80% of white men were voting. There was a demographic and political revolution that went on. And what we know is political parties began really to develop in order to organize this new mass of voters. Professional politicians were invented, you'll be glad to hear, so that you can get voters to the polls and distribute literature, deal out patronage and spoils. The spoil system was an invention from New York, but it was quickly adopted elsewhere. All of this democratization proceeded apace, and it gave new reasons for political parties to be vigorous. And it reinvigorated the politics at the national level as well. What we think of as the sort of routine battles between the Congress and the President really date from the Jacksonian period. This was the first time that, in a strong sense, the Congress and the President argued about who was more representative of the American people. There had been a kind of acceptance of each as representative in its own way until this time. Combined with rising sectional tensions over slavery in particular, this was really the opening for regular political parties to enter into our politics. Even that didn't, this need for political parties didn't make them respectable quite yet. Something may be necessary, something may be useful, and still not respectable. And it really wasn't until Andrew Jackson was president, Martin Van Buren was his vice president, that the first sort of Burkean argument explicitly was raised, publicly was raised in America, about how a public interchange of the two parties, a public taking turns by the two parties, was not only inevitable, tolerable, but actually good for the country. And if properly organized, it could be a respectable way to play the parties off against each other, make each of them the better guardian of the Constitution. If they could compete to interpret the Constitution correctly, if they could compete to defend the Constitution against misinterpretation and misapplication of power, then you had found a way to make parties respectable in American politics because they promoted the underlying consensus that was necessary in our politics. They agreed on the Constitution, and they disagreed only on who was the better protector of the Constitution, who was the better guardian of the Constitution. How far that situation is from ours today, I leave to your imagination and to the question period. Thank you very much.